I believe my impression is that the rabbis have guilt feelings over the commentary that they do to the Torah. Put it differently, they're conflicted about reinterpreting the Torah. They basically are asked themselves all the time, how can we be in machloket, in dispute with the tradition? Then how can we be in machloket with the past? And the law of the Ben Sored, the defiant child, the rebellious child, becomes a fertile ground for them to think about this. I want to learn one daf of Talmud together with you. And it deals with different dynasties, Shoshanot dynasties. These dynasties are all biblical. And I think these biblical characters all reveal themselves to be rebellious children, Banim Sovereign. And what we will see is that on the one hand, they really are Sovereign, they are rebellious. And on the other hand, they're not all bad, which maybe isn't surprising. Since these are biblical characters, and some of them positive biblical characters, the outcome is a legitimacy to confront tradition. So a person has a rebellious offspring, and then listen to their parents. They chastise him, and he continues to not listen. So we see this is an ongoing behavior. They take hold of him. They take him out to the elders of the town. They say to the elders, he is rebellious. And then he doesn't listen to us. He's gluttonous and a drunk. All the people of his town stone him, you purge the evil from your midst, and everyone shall hear and fear. The basics of this law are that whoever rebels against the tradition deserves the death penalty. I have an echoing of another pasuk in my mind, right? Shema b'ni musar avicha. Listen to the ethics, the laws of your father. Don't go against the law of your mother. That's what's happening here. Okay, when there's a child who decides, an offspring, I don't know if he's necessarily young, right? Could be a grown-up, some offspring going against his parents, the punishment in our tradition is the death penalty. Okay, our tradition decides that, and that's something we can't handle. Okay. And as I said, now I want to trail a few biblical characters who are known as Banim Sorerim and see what their qualities are. What's the quality of their betrayal, of their sorerut, okay, of their merida, their rebellion. So let's start with the first. The first is hinted to, and we'll see in a minute the development in the traditional texts from the Tanaitic sources and the way they just very lightly hint to the Talmudic sources that become a bit more explicit, and then the later Midrashim that become openly explicit about who this character is. And the Tanaitic Midrash is based on a principle of smichut parshiyot. Smichut parshiyot is the following principle. Nothing is incidental in the Torah. It's the holy text. Everything has meaning. And so when two biblical laws are one next to the other, there's room to give that proximity meaning. We don't only give meaning to the content, we also give meaning to form when we're learning the Torah. So just the fact that these two are one next to the other physically must have meaning. And what we see is that the Ben Sorel Moed, the law of the wild and unruly child, is close to another biblical law, which we call Eshet Yifat Torah. Eshet Yifat Torah is the following case. There's war, a soldier sees a woman who he wants to take for himself, and the law basically says he can, but he has to give her a month to mourn her family, her parents, not go to her right away, but give it time. Okay? That's the sublimation, so to speak, okay, of the yetzer that happens right immediately in the context of the law. The Midrash asks about the connection of these two laws, the law of the Eshet Yifat Torah, this woman who one wants to take in the context of war, and the Ben Soreh Umoreh. So we're going to turn to the Mechilta. The Mechilta says the following. Avim Shem Zeh Chashaf Yifat Torah, right? The father of this boy lusted a beautiful woman and brought into his home a stumbling block. And his son became a wayward and defiant son. And his end will bring him to kill him in an unnatural way. In other words, we turn the proximity into cause and effect, right? You bring this woman into your home. Something is broken in your home. The outcome is going to be a child who revolts against you. This is the Tanaitic level. The Talmud already has a name of who this parent is. Okay, and the Talmud tells us about the following conversation. And towards David came Hushai Ha'aspit. Hushai is one of David's friends, advisors. Okay? This is from Sanhedrin, from the Divine Sanhedrin. David said to Hushai, if you marry a beautiful woman, an Eshet Yifat Torah, did not the Torah permit this? Right, the Torah tells us how to do this. So how legitimate to do this. What's the problem? Hushai responded, why did you not explicate these verses in proximity? Why didn't you learn from the proximity? As it says, if a man has a wayward and defiant son, he will indeed have a wayward and defiant son. Okay, so suddenly, there's a biblical character here. There's David, who is being told, it's true that an Eshet Yifat Torah is legitimate. But there's implications to that kind of action. As we know, David had many wives and many children. The Midrashim tried to locate who his wild and who his rebellious son is. You want to give a guess?
Okay.
Any person who marries an Eshet Yifat Torah, Parman Denasi Yifat Torah, Nafik Mineh will have come from him a Ben Soreh Umoreh, wayward and defiant son, as we find with David, Yatsa Mimeno Avshalom. Those are the three next words in the Midrash. Okay, I'm sorry. We are now focusing on David and Avshalom. And Avshalom is our Ben Soreh Umoreh. He revolts against his father. Yes.
At least the Torah permits to be Eshet Yifat Torah, but Bat Sheva was not permitted. So what is the comparison?
There was an assumption in your question that who is David's Eshet Yifat Torah?
Bat Sheva.
Okay, I think that's interesting because David's not a soldier in the context in which Bat Sheva is taken. Okay? Okay, so now I want to do something a little bit outrageous. I want to skim through 8 chapters of Shmuel Ben. Because I want us to remember the details of the story. What I'm looking for is the qualities or the characteristics of Avshalom's rebellion. What is he criticizing in his father? That's the question. Okay. When kings go out, they go out to war, he sends his general Yoav and all his slaves, all his soldiers with him, to go and have a war with Bnei Amon. So the first description here, right, of the general going out and the soldiers going out, and where is David? Not at the front of the army. Okay? Not where we would expect a great king and a great leader to be. He is home. And of course, there's trouble. Vayile et erev, comes the evening. Vayakom David ba'al mishkavo. I am glad that he's sleepless. just chavad that this is what he's doing, right? Vayitalech al gav meito. Vayar isha rochetet, he sees a woman bathing, and vayisha tovat mar'em be'ov. There's an association with the eshet yifat toah, okay? Vayishlach David vayidrosh la'isha, and he kind of wants to know who this woman is. He's told, this is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah Hittite. He's immediately told that she has a husband. Vayishlach David malachim, and he sends messengers and takes her, and she comes to him, and he sleeps with her. Vayishkav imo. She becomes pregnant. That baby is lost. It does not survive, okay? Vayishtom David sefer el Yoav. Vayishlach Uriah. Okay, Uriah comes back, and he sends a message, which Uriah holds, which is his own, right, being put to death. Vayechtov b'sefer le'emor, he writes in the book, I'm at the end of the first paragraph that you have, havu et Uriah el mul pnei milchama achazaka. Send Uriah to the kind of hard, strong war, make sure that he is killed. Okay, and that's the husband of Bathsheba. Okay. Scene 2. Vayomer Natan el David, okay, comes the prophet Natan to David and basically says, how could you do this double thing, right, of both taking a married woman and murder? Madua bazita et dvar Hashem la'asot hara be'enav? Why did you do this terrible thing? Sending Uriah this way to war, taking his wife and so on. And the punishment is, lo tasu chelo mibeitcha. Your home is going to be a home of death, a home of, well, I don't know, killing or death. Okay, it's not clear here. But here is the prophecy, maybe, of the Ben Sorel, right? Ko amar Hashem, hineni mekim alecha ra'a mibeitcha. The evil is going to come from within your home. Ve'lakachti et neshecha, your wives will be taken away from you, and so on and so forth, that soon we'll see Shalom actually doing this to David. The chapter in scene 2 ends with David being trying to comfort Bathsheba, Vayenachem David et Bathsheba ishto, and comes to her again, a son is born, she calls him Shlomo, Natan calls him Yedidya ba'avur Hashem, that he is, okay, a friend, a fellow of God. Scene 3, Avshalom has a sister, her name is Tamar. I'll remind us again, David has many wives and many children. Avshalom and Tamar are children of the same mother and father. Okay. And now comes a new character, Amnon. Amnon is in love with Tamar. He only shares the father, David. Okay? Vayomer Amnon el Tamar, boy shechvi imi achoti, come my sister, lay with me. She begs that he please not rape her. He doesn't listen. Lo avar ishmo bekona. Vayechezak mimena. He's stronger than her. Vayeanea. He rapes her. And again, we have suddenly a description of focus on David. Ve'amelech David shama et kol hadvarim ha'ele vayichar lo me'od. What is David's response? Really angry. That's it. Okay. Scene 4, a couple of years later, Avshalom is marking the shearing of the sheep, and he commands his servants, Re'u kitov lev Amnon bayayin, take opportunity when Amnon is drunk, okay, he orchestrates a big party of Shalom, and invites his brothers, including Amnon, and tells his servants when Amnon is drunk, Amnon, hit Amnon, kill Amnon, ve'amitem oto. Okay, so Avshalom takes matters into his own hands. Chizku ve'yu livnei chayil. Okay, be kind of soldiers. Be like brave men. Okay, and now Avshalom, they indeed go out and do this. And David is back home very worried. He heard that there was this big party, and he's afraid all his sons were killed there. And he's comforted. No, Amnon levadomet. It's only Amnon who was killed al pi Avshalom. In other words, he totally knows. Hayta shuma miyad miyom anito et amarachoto. He's being told Amnon was killed because Avshalom was angry at him since he raped his sister. Okay, so the description is very explicit to David. And Avshalom knows his father's going to be upset with him, and he runs away. Vayelech Kshur, he goes to his grandfather, okay, in Kshur, and he spends 3 years there. Okay? Moving on to scene 5, Vayeda Yoav ben Tzruya. Yoav knows that David is pining for his son Avshalom. And Yoav orchestrates a reunion. But at the moment of truth, Vayomer HaMelech Yisov el Beito Ufanai Lo Yireh. He sends Avshalom home and isn't willing to see him. Okay? This is now 5 years later. Okay? A long time has passed and he still doesn't see Avshalom. And at the end of scene 5, there is a meeting between Avshalom and his father. Vayavo Yoav el HaMelech Vayagin Lo Vayikra el Avshalom. He calls Avshalom to come to the king. He bows down to the king and he kisses. And the king kisses Avshalom. What word is missing in this little last description? His son. The description of the meeting is between a king and his, probably Latin.
Subject.
Okay? Not a father and his, okay? And his son. Okay. And just to remind us the very end, now Avshalom has a full-blown open revolt against his father. Vahim Achar Ken, Avshalom makes himself a chariot and horses and people, you know, to be his entourage. And Avshalom says, Mi yasimeni shofet, I'm going to be the judge in all the land. I love this. This is one of the best lines in the Tanakh. Right? What does Avshalom say? Kol ish asher yeh lo riv, whoever has any dispute with anybody, umishpat, he should come to me, and what will I do? Itzdaktiv, I will make him righteous. Right, you just pay me enough and I will find you all. Consider me king and I will find you all righteous. Okay, so openly I'm going against what's straight. And then a very significant word. But Yignov Avshalom. Avshalom steals the heart of the people. Okay, Avshalom steals the heart of the people. Whoever wants can skim the continuation. But the continuation is basically that Achitofel gives Avshalom very good advice on how to take over David and to win that war between the two of them. Avshalom does not listen to Achitofel, and so Avshalom loses the battle against David. Achitofel isn't a neutral character in this dynasty, right? Who is he? You're nodding. He is Bathsheba's grandfather, okay? So he is upset with David for other reasons. And he sides with Avshalom. Okay. And now my question is, what is Avshalom's critique of his father?
That there was no justice taken against Amnon. And that, David wanted to sweep him under the rug.
Right. No justice against Amnon. Other point of critique that Avshalom has against his father?
Bathsheba.
Right? Maybe he knows about it. Okay? He sees how his father acts. Right? Bathsheba and Uriah. Right? You can say both. He takes a married woman and he kills her husband. Good. Okay. What else?
Well, this stuff with Bathsheba and Shlomo could make him think, well, he's the one who should be worthy to take his father's place.
Great. In other words, al pnei hashetach, right? On the surface, it's kids fighting against which one is going to be the next king. Shlomo is not the oldest one necessarily in this array of children that David has. He wants to be king. Pshut meod, right? Very simple. He doesn't approve of who his father has chosen to take over from him. Yoch. Okay.
We're never told that David made any effort to reconcile
with Avshalom.
With Avshalom.
And so you're saying, you're my father. Avshalom says like this, you're my father, you be the bigger man. Something like that, right? You're angry with me, Dad, but you also have to make some steps here, right? Something like that. At a very kind of human, personal level.
Avshalom would say, I did what you should have done, which is resentful but also supplanting at the same time. When he does come back in this ambivalent, come back, but I'm not going to see you. Then when he greets him, he's like, so you want to be me? So you're not my son. You know, and so it's, David doesn't take the opportunity to reestablish the relationship between them. And so what started off as the, I did what you couldn't do, is like, fine, then I'll be you.
All the way.
You know.
Right. Okay, yes. There's war and he stays at home. There's a raid and he doesn't respond. Absalom runs away. Absalom kills his brother, right? All these things. And David is extremely passive. Okay? David is extremely passive. And so I want to suggest that Absalom's critique of his father is, first of all, a moral one. Right? You mentioned many of the things. How are you a leader? What is murder? Family relationships, all the sexual inappropriate behavior, okay? All those things, the critique of Absalom, it's hard not to feel for Absalom, not to identify with him. Okay, now, I don't know what the biblical narrator wanted us to feel, okay? But at the end of the day, Absalom is considered the bad guy who revolts against David inappropriately, and he gets killed for it, okay? And yet, when we start unpacking the story, he has very real and justified critique of his father. And here I want to be careful with how I speak, because it's critique of his father and critique of the king. And the two are totally blended, right? And they're blended. Both the passive father is being criticized and the passive king is being criticized. And he's being criticized by his subject and he's being criticized by his son. Okay, and the two are completely entwined. So that's the story of Absalom. So I want to leave Absalom aside now and go to the next biblical character. But before I do that, I'm just going to point out one thing. I'm not going to go into the discussion, into the Talmudic discussion at this point, but I do want you to notice that it has very, very, very many of the verses we read. That's number one. And number two is that if you need to mark the name that appears most often in these verses is the name of Shalom. Okay? And that's why when I look at this sugiyah, I first of all open up all these verses, and second of all, what I see is of Shalom, of Shalom, of Shalom, of Shalom. Okay? And this is the third amud in the discussion of the Ben Soel. Okay? The next biblical character I want to introduce with the verses that describe him. Abraham. Okay? Or in the dynasty of Terah, Haran, Sarah, Yitzchak. Okay, that's our dynasty. Let's just read the verses. Okay, Terah shivim shana. Okay, Terah lived 70 years. He had Abraham, Nachor, and Haran. He had 3 children. Now this is the line of Terah. Terah had Abraham, Nachor, and Haran. Haran had Lot. Okay, Lot. Haran died in the lifetime of his father Terach, in his native land, in Kasdim. Abraham and Nahor, right, the two other children of Terach, took wives for themselves. Who were their wives? The name of Abraham's wife was, we all know, Sarai. And that of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Now, the verse tells us something about Milcah, the daughter of Haran. Remember, Haran is one of Abraham's brothers. One of Abraham had Lot, and he had Milcah. And look what the verse tells us. The father of Milcah and Yiscah. So just to get the family tree here, we have Terah. Terah has 3 children, Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran has 3 children, Lot, Milcah, and Yiscah. Milcah marries her uncle Nahor. Now to make it a perfect picture, we want Yiscah to marry Abraham, right? And so the Midrash is going to say, Yiscah is actually son. Okay? Just to make a perfect picture here. Mitzuyan. Okay. So that's the first step that's going to happen here. You can look in the Gemara. You see there's 3 sections in the Gemara that follow. Okay, the middle section, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Yiscah zo Sarah. Okay? There's the Midrash telling us that Yiscah is actually Sarah and giving all kinds of reasons why. Okay. Great. Now, there's one more thing that happens in the Maravid, in the Midrash. Ele toldot Terach, Terach olid Abraham, right? That's the verse we were looking, right? Terach begot, gave birth to Abraham, Nachor, and Haran. Abraham was older than Nachor by 1 year. Nachor was older than Haran by 1 year. We found that Abraham was older than Haran 2 years. Basic math, okay? What's interesting about this Midrash is not the Midrash itself, but the context in which it appears. Because this is a small segment of a much longer Midrash that we have in Bereshit Rabba. The idol story. And I'm going to remind you the question. The question is, what are the characteristics of the wild and unruly child, the revolting child? Haran died in the lifetime of his father. Said Rabbi Chiya, Terach Ovet Tzlamim Haya. Terach was an idol worshiper. Chadman, once upon a time, he left and let Abraham sit and sell the idols in his place. Came a man and wanted to buy. Abraham said to him, how old are you? He said to him, 50. He said to him, oh, a person who's 50 and who's worshiping something that is a day old? He was ashamed and he left. Another time came a woman carrying pinach de sol, a plate full of flour. She said to him, take it please and give it to the idol. He got up, he took a stick of Abraham, and he broke all the idols. And he gave the stick, he put the stick in the hand of the biggest idol there. When his father came home, he said to him, what did this to them? Abraham said, I can't lie. A woman came, she had some flour, a plate full of flour. She said, give it to them. This one said, I'll eat first. And this one said, I'll eat first. And came, got up the biggest one, took a stick and broke all the others. Said to him, his father, kidding me? Do you think I don't have any knowledge? Abraham said to him, think of what you're saying. Scene 3. He took him, right, like you do to a Ben Sorer. You took him and he gave him to Nimrod, the elders of the town. Nimrod was the king. He said to him, worship the fire. Abraham said, maybe we should worship the water to take out the fire. Nimrod said, worship the water. Abraham said, maybe we should worship the clouds that bring the water. He said to him, worship the clouds. He said, then maybe we should worship the wind that brings the clouds. He said to him, worship the wind. He said to him, maybe we should worship people who can withstand the wind. He said to him, Nimrod said to Abraham, you're playing around. Worship the fire. You won't worship the fire, I will throw you into the fire and become your God and save you. Again, in the end, we know that Abraham indeed was saved. So now I'm asking you again, what are the qualities of the Ben Sorer, the rebellious son here?
Emotional.
He doesn't listen, right?
He sees the inconsistencies and inadequacies of his father.
Mm-hmm. See the inconsistencies and points them out to him. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else?
He keeps escalating.
What do you mean?
The first was just words, then there was damage, then there's like peril to life and limb. It gets, you know, more and more consequential.
It's interesting. The who's in peril? Whose life and limb are in peril?
Well, I guess his own, right?
So, okay. Yeah. It's interesting. The Mishnah says that one of the things that the wild and unruly child, Ben Sorer, does is steal from his parents. Okay, and clearly here he's, right, this is his father's livelihood, okay, that he's breaking.
But you could still threaten your parents by hurting yourself.
Yes, yes, that's a good point. Yes.
Yes, and the rabbis appear to be writing in a way that is highly sympathetic to Abraham. I mean, yes, he's you know, annoying, he talks back, and he's disobedient and rebellious, and the rabbis are making clear that the authority figures to whom he's talking back are idiots.
it almost contradicts the verse in Deuteronomy where we started. In other words, Avram can be seen as the quintessential mentor, but rather than the community, Avram's the one who will, by Yahel, you know, create a community. And the community doesn't hold actually Avram responsible for his own transgressions, let alone for how he acted towards his father.
Mm-hmm.
So especially with the story with Nimrod, I couldn't help but think about also some of Gemara and the back and forth between Abraham and God about this sort of, well, if not this, then that, not this, then that. But to Jonathan's question, which is, if this is all about the father, where does that play out? Because we wouldn't talk in the same way about David or Terah as we would the Holy One in that particular conversation. Is there a parallel there to Abraham's behavior in those two moments?
It's interesting, I think. What you're pointing out is that this is a great midrash that it's a similar Abraham, right? Unlike the Abraham that we meet in the Akedah, this is a similar Abraham. Mm-hmm. That the midrash here is really based on his characteristics. It's not surprising. Mm-hmm. Maybe what you and Jonathan meant to say, which hasn't been said yet, is surprising to see Abraham as a ben sohar.
But the thing that's interesting with the examples of David and Abraham is that the rabbis are making a point, which is that your father being an idiot or your father being immoral are not excuses to be a ben sohar immoral. It doesn't get you off the hook. You still have to be respectful, even if your father's an idiot. You still can't profess.
A lot of things
about that.
You are connected.
Yes. No, the opposite can be true too. Right? Like if you engage in an activity that might be permitted but is morally incorrect, you will get a picture for the rest of your life of your immorality while it's legal. And that ben sohar is the picture of your immorality that you will need to carry and the fire to kill it. So that you have to kill the ben sohar.
Just the last thing you said, I didn't understand. He will get a picture of your morality.
Of your immorality. Right, so, and therefore, you want to eliminate that. Therefore, yes, la mito, right?
You're a little bit being Freud, nachon? You're saying, you're saying, my children reflect my weaknesses, not only my strengths. And then, when it's really bad, what I want to do is eliminate them.
There's a balance, right? Blind obedience isn't ultimately desired. Neither is complete and utter rejection.
What makes you think that blind obedience isn't desired?
So what's the idea is like is nitzchuni bana, right? Like there's a joy when you're if you are in a healthy and vital relationship, a certain kind of pushback, resistance, roundabout thinking is encouraged. When it goes too far, it destroys the structure and it's too dangerous. If it's nothing, is that person ever going to be the king? Like, is that person going, you know, the...
You're saying Avshalom went too far. That's why he isn't king. He went too far, maybe like you're suggesting, in the way he criticized his father. So and that's why...
I don't know if that would work with David or not. I think that the critique of him that I'm making, yes, is that he didn't rein it in.
Let's take a couple of more comments. Yes.
Where do you see in the text that Abraham wasn't been any hint or reference to Ben Sohar or Moreh?
I was waiting for somebody to ask that question.
I'm just like in here.
Yeah. Where in the text do I see that Abraham is a Ben Sohar? Okay, good question. I'll only half answer you. The half answer I want to say is the following. What we're doing now is not, I didn't collect random characters that I think are Benim Sohrim. We are following Daf Samechtet Amud Bet in Masechet Sanhedrin, which is the third Amud of the chapter of Ben Sohar. And so this is a discussion within the context of Ben Sohar. My understanding of the way Talmud works is that when biblical characters appear, they are not only there to answer the little technical question that is specifically asked, but that they want to teach us something broader about the topic at hand. Okay? So that's my answer. I hope we'll have time to say something about the context of the conversation before we end. But that's the answer to your question. Yes.
I just think it's interesting that in the pasuk from Deuteronomy, it says father, mother, and then official. And then what we have in the Midrash that you shared with us is you have mother, father, and Nimrod, the official.
100%. In other words, this is also an answer to Abe, I think. In other words, if we start mapping out what happens with the law of Bezla Omoet, a lot of it fits in Baham. The Tfos Benehotzi, and the graph to take out and to take to the official of the is there.
I guess what I'm struggling with, I've been so maybe brainwashed, I only focus on the second half of the verses here about he is a glutton and a drunkard. I don't even think about the verses before, so I don't know how the rabbis are, or this midrash, because do we have any indication Abraham was a drunken or a glutton? I don't think so. They're just focusing on that first one.
Not that I can remember. And what happens in the Talmudic chapter is that the first piece is actually about sexual inappropriate behavior. The second piece is the piece we're learning now, which is some sort of revolt against father slash leader. And the third section is what I call the addict, which is the glutton and the drunkard. Okay, but it appears only in the third part of the Talmudic discussion and Bemet in the Mishnah a little later.
I was just thinking about there's a famous poem by Yehuda Amichai that plays with this role. It only works well with Abraham and Terach, but bringing this midrash, Amichai says something like, Abraham created Judaism by revolting against Terach. Maybe it's the time for us to do to Abraham what Abraham did to Terach. And it's playing a little bit with this betrayal and continuity that at least works very well with Abraham. It doesn't work with the rest of the cases.
Yofi, so I think I want to say the following, that if we characterize Avshalom as revolting on a moral plane against his father, right, that's his main critique, the morality of his father and the passivity. Here, the critique is theological, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think also what you were saying, right, the form is there's something not logical. Now, the softer version is it doesn't make sense to me, and the harsher version is it doesn't make sense. Okay? And it's somewhere along that plane. And I think where that poem is echoed in my mind, it's quite outrageous to think of Abraham as a ben soel umoel. And on the other hand, there's no doubt that vis-a-vis his father, that's what he was. Okay? And it's a huge stop sign to the tradition. If you kill the ben soel umoel, if you actually play this out, these are the kind of things you're going to destroy. You're going to stop from happening. Okay?
Right. Don't you think that that's the tension that the Stama is pulling together? The difference between making a judgment and taking an action according to the future behavior, the future outcome of this child if left to his own devices, over against what would be so terrible if you let him go to the end of his devices, if you let him be. Because we're judging the rabbis go to great lengths to judge the child in terms of his future actions, right? And to say, we can write this law out of Torah, and it never happened, and then wait. But it did. We have a rabbinic self-consciousness playing out here in the tension between an argument to judge unfavorably based on the predicted outcome for the child, and the question of whether we actually should permit that, right? And that it's our own fear of relinquishing the established tradition, which is in this case the rule of the father, and the father's dominion over the actions of their children,
right?
Right.
And I am not sure if the piece in the Mishnah and then in the Gemara of Nidon Hashem Sofot that is judgment, I am not sure that's echoing in this sugiya. I think it's worth a conversation. Think about it. And the other thing I want to say is that this goes to an even more, right? This, the Abraham story here is an extreme because it says if you don't let this child revolt against you, then there's death, right? Then there's no Judaism, then there's no, okay? So it's extreme in that sense, okay? So, and here I want to say that I don't know if the rabbis identify with the father or with the son. In other words, we perceive the rabbis as holding tradition. But part of what I am suggesting is that this is a way for them to grapple their own identities as Banim Soharim. Because how dare we reinterpret? How dare we do this? Okay, and so I think they're finding characters to identify with that are, have some legitimacy within the tradition. The third dynasty is the dynasty of Bezalel, Ben Uri, Ben Hur. Hur is the son of Kalil. Okay? And it's a fantastic dynasty. So Kalev is there, but it has Kalev with the Am, right? It silences everybody and it's source number four. And Moshe, the Yom, and no, we will go and inherit the land. And Ashirim, Asher, and we don't. Everybody else says, Mapitom, they're stronger than us. We can't go into the land. So Kalev goes against what everybody is saying. Kalev ben Chetzron. And they say, what do you mean ben Chetzron? His name is Kalev ben Yefune. Why was he called Kalev ben Yefune? In source number two, he turned away from the Meraglim. So I don't know, that's mamash the act. Mazel lasur ben sorer umore is to shift, to do that move, so it's the same move. That's Kalev. Now one of the most heartbreaking midrashim, which was in our parashat, and we heard Rabbeitan a little bit remind us of the context, okay? Moshe goes up to get the luchot, who remains in charge in source number three? Aharon and Hur, they stay, they're in charge. Okay, but then when the people want to build the calf, who do they turn to? Aharon, what happened to Hur? So the Midrash completes and tells us what happened to Hur. At the time when the Israelites were about to commit the act of making the golden calf, they first came to Hur and they said to him, make us a god. Since he did not listen to them, they rose up and slew him. Okay? Terrible. It's a heartbreaking midrash. Okay, but this is Hur. Everyone comes to him and says, build us the calf. And what does he say? No. So he comes from that kind of a family. That's what his father did. And that's what now, it's what his father will do. The Meraglim haven't been sent yet. But in the lineage here, that's where it comes from. And the last character here is Bezalel. When you have time, you'll look at it in this midrash. Basically, Bezalel doesn't build the Mishkan exactly the way Moshe tells him that God told him to do it. And it's one of these beautiful moments where God agrees and accepts what Bezalel does, even though he didn't say it. Okay? He schema dato. In hindsight, he accepts the way Bezalel builds the Mishkan. We have here three different models of offspring revolting. Okay? And as I said, I think the rabbis use this as a tool for themselves to characterize types of rebellion and maybe even to make the act of rebellion, which is really the act of Midrash, legitimate. The first one is Avshalom, who goes more to the negative, but even though when we look at his critique, it's hard not to accept it. We see that the rabbis are struggling with David also. It's hard to accept him as a moral person, and it's hard to accept his passivity. Avraham revolts on a theological plane and on a logical plane. And he, to me, is the strongest model of kind of looking in the mirror of what it would mean to actually not accept any of our next generation's revolts. Okay? And the third one are these independent thinkers. Okay, Bezalel, Hur, Kalev, who dare to say no when there's a whole mass of people demanding something different. Because three different, very different characters of sorerut, of being other, of being revolting, but all of which have merits. The opening line of our Sugya introduces a dispute between Dechanai and Betileit. They recognize that reality in biblical times is different than their own reality. Even on the biological level of how people are. And now they have a dilemma. Can they learn? Can we learn from biblical times or not? If reality has changed so much, can we learn from biblical times? An obvious question, and quite an outrageous question, if you stop a minute to think about it. Okay? And that's the last line here. Bet Shammai Savrei Gomrinan Migorot HaRishonim. Bet Shammai maintained that we do learn from earlier generations. The Rosh Hashanah are the ones who lived in the period of the Tanakh. Bet Hillel, Savrei, Lo Gomrinan Migorot HaRishonim. Bet Hillel maintained that we do not learn from earlier generations. Now, they're talking about a very specific point. What age kids can enter Beit Hillel. But you hear that the Gemara puts it as a principal question. Okay? And it's, right, it's the eternal question of interpreters, of rabbis, of Banim Sorerim, right? When is it essential for tradition to me, for me to revolt against it because reality has changed so much that actually for continuity's sake, I need to revolt against it. And when is it a break that is a total change and not continuity? And then I'm no longer within the tradition.